chain issues. He was under investigation by Congress. They finally folded the program he was involved in because, like just about everything else Jared Kushner touched during the Trump administration, this thing fell apart.
You know, I'm wondering how you respond, and we just have a minute, to arguments that, oh, well, you're just really an anti-vaxxer, even the same with Professor Menchik, attacking him as that. How you can be pro-vaccine but anti-profiteering?
I thank God for the vaccines. I am double vaccinated and boosted, and if there's another booster coming, I'm going to be first in line to get it. I think these are incredibly vital to saving people's lives at this point and going forward. And the fact of the matter is, I want these vaccines to be available to everyone, not blocked via profiteering and failed government policies. I want them available to everyone in the United States and around the world. And I know from doing this book that that is possible.
John Nichols, I want to thank you for being with us, the nation's national affairs correspondent. His new book coming out later this month, Coronavirus Criminals and Pandemic Profiteers, Accountability for Those Who Cause the Crisis. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for Human Resources Manager. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maratia Sena, Tammy Warrenoff, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tay Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Conlon, Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m. streaming online. Racial and social justice activist Ajama Umi will deliver a keynote presentation addressed, Does American Identity Equal White Supremacy? This MLK Observance will also feature a Q&A session, songs, and readings. Again, that's the 19th annual Silverton MLK Observance on Monday, January 19th from 6 to 7 p.m. streaming online. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today on Sojourner Truth, the latest on the COVID-19 pandemic, the impact of Omicron, the rollout of free home tests, and what we all should be concerned about and what we should be doing. Is this the new normal? Our guest is Dr. David Hammelstein, Distinguished Professor of Public Health at the City University of New York and a lecturer at Harvard University. And the latest on the child tax credits, as payments that were expected later this week to millions of families will not arrive. Why? Because Congress has failed to extend the payments. We will find out why, the impact of the child tax credit, and who are the blockers in Congress, the state of play on efforts to save the child tax credits, including upcoming national actions. We speak with Emma Marabi, Director of Poverty Policy at the Washington, D.C.-based Children's Defense Fund. Live in a global world, we're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandari. President Biden, for the first time, publicly called on the Senate to lift its filibuster rules to allow a majority vote to pass voting rights legislation. There is no indication that holdout Democrats Joe Manchin or Kyrsten Sinema are any closer to voting for a rules change. Christopher Martinez reports.
President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris traveled to the grounds of Atlanta Clark University and Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, to make their case. There, Biden announced his new position.
Today, I'm making it clear, to protect our democracy, I support changing the Senate rules, whichever way they need to be changed, to prevent a minority of senators from blocking action on voting rights.
Biden says if states can pass voter suppression laws with a simple majority vote, the Senate should be able to protect democracy by a majority vote, not the 60 votes needed to end a filibuster. Some voting rights advocates boycotted the event, saying they were protesting Biden's inaction on the issue in recent months. Biden says he's been working behind the scenes, but that was then.
I've been having these quiet conversations with the members of Congress for the last 2 months. I'm tired of being quiet.
Senate leader Chuck Schumer plans to bring up a vote on the Freedom to Vote Act, and if it fails, he'll hold a vote on the filibuster by January 17th, Martin Luther King holiday. I'm Christopher Martinez.
The Biden administration is increasing federal support for COVID-19 testing for schools in a bid to keep them open amid the Omicron surge. The White House says the administration is making a dedicated stream of 5 million rapid tests and 5 million lab-based PCR tests available to schools starting this month. The administration has come under sharp criticism for not ensuring adequate testing supplies as the Omicron variant has surged. Chicago's school children returned to the classroom today after the district and the teachers union reached agreement on COVID safety protocols. The school district will offer more COVID-19 testing and have standards to close schools related to infection rates. The agreement must still be ratified by members of the teachers union. Chicago Mayor Lori Lightfoot, meantime, announced she has tested positive and is feeling mild symptoms. Lightfoot said she was fully vaccinated and boosted. About a third of Los Angeles public school students were not in the classroom yesterday on the first day back to school after the winter break. Students were required to show a negative COVID test to return. Those who didn't submit a test result were tested on the spot. Los Angeles Interim Schools Chief Megan Riley said officials are committed to keeping kids learning in person in the nation's second largest school district.
LA Unified maintains the highest COVID-19 safety standards of any public school district in the nation, including weekly testing of all staff and students, universal masking indoors and outdoors, comprehensive sanitizing efforts, frequent hand washing, upgraded air filtration systems, physical distance as much as possible.
Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti joined Riley at a middle school and said schools are the safest place for kids to be. The Los Angeles Teachers Union tweeted that it had demanded structures for a safe return to in-person learning for students and educators, adding, "That's planning, solidarity, and power." Tennis star Novak Djokovic admits he knew he had tested positive for COVID-19 when he attended a newspaper interview and photo shoot in Serbia last month. He says he made an error of judgment and should immediately have gone into isolation. The tennis star has also blamed human error by his support team for failing to declare that he had traveled in the two-week period before entering Australia. Upon arrival, his visa was revoked and then reinstated. The ongoing saga is over whether he should be allowed into Australia despite not being vaccinated against COVID-19. Prime Minister Boris Johnson has apologized for attending a garden party during Britain's coronavirus lockdown. Johnson acknowledged for the first time that he was at the May 2020 garden party at his Downing Street office, though he said he had considered it a work event.
I regret very much that we did not do things differently that evening, Mr. Speaker, as I've said, and I take responsibility and I apologize.
Johnson is facing anger from the public and politicians over the claims that he and his staff flouted pandemic restrictions by socializing when it was banned. The Labour Party leader has said he should resign. Consumer prices jumped 7% in December from a year earlier. It's the highest inflation rate since 1982. I'm Eileen Alfandary for Pacifica Radio.
But we're now going to start our show focusing on the child tax credit. With the Build Back Better Act not extended, with Congress not acting before the holidays, the expanded child tax credit has expired, and millions of children across the United States will yet again slip into poverty. A Census Bureau survey has found that the expanded child tax credit has helped families with children to buy more food, pay for household expenses. And indeed, 9 out of 10 families with low incomes have used the child tax credit to pay for necessities, for education, clothing, and more. According to the Poor People's Campaign, 140 million people in the United States are poor and low wealth. And with Congress refusing to act on the child tax credit, they're basically throwing millions of children under the bus. Let's go to a couple of clips now, one from CNN on the child tax credit, followed by a grandma, Carolyn Hill, speaking out about the child tax credit. Let's go to those clips now.
I would like a waffle, please.
You'd like a waffle?
At breakfast, Jesse and his sister Madison can have whatever they want.
Thank you.
But their mom, Emily Hardin, says that wasn't always the case.
There were a lot of times where we didn't have, you know, more than a couple of dollars and had to kind of decide, like, I wasn't going to eat so that he could eat.
But now the family is on steadier footing, thanks in part to a monthly child tax credit, or CTC, from the federal government. This year, families are getting $3,000 per child ages 6 to 17 and $3,600 for children under 6. That's up from $2,000 per child.
It's been a really big deal for us.
This single mom makes a modest salary of $34,000 as the pastor of the Church of the Covenant in Grafton, West Virginia. Bills have always been tight and still are, but the $6,600 in child tax credit she's getting makes a difference.
Being less worried about those kind of everyday expenses, which, you know, if you're worried about everyday expenses, you're worried every day, has meant that I feel less stressed.
But that stress is starting to build again. The Senate must pass the Build Back Better bill by December 28th to continue CTC benefits at the current amounts. Part of the holdup is West Virginia Senator Joe Manchin, who has concerns about the overall cost of the bill.
We are potentially risking 50,000 West Virginia citizens or children who are benefiting from the CTC to either be pushed further down into poverty or actually cross into the poverty line.
And across the country, it's nearly 10 million children at risk.
Come here, come to mommy.
The Butchers, down one salary after Anna lost her job during the pandemic, say it would be devastating to lose the $6,600 in tax credits for their two children.
The 4-year-old and the 15-year-old, they're never going to go hungry, but it's a different story for us, and sometimes we have to make those kind of decisions.
91% of low-income families use their CTC on food, education, and other basic needs. The Butchers are looking at cutting their grocery bill, but with prices rising across the board, it's nearly impossible.
Our food budget, which is pretty low at this point, so I don't see us being able to to go much lower with that. It's scary because I'm not really sure what our next step is going to look like.
Hi, my name is Carolyn Hill, and I had two nieces that DHS had took from me. Now I have three grandkids that I had custody of. And what child tax credit means to me is that if I had been getting it back then, I probably would have still had my nieces. And now that I have my grandkids, it meant that we got a chance to go to Wildwood, Great Adventures. They're a little happy. My bills are all being paid. And child tax credit meant a whole lot to this family. We mothers are working. We do have a job. We have to make sure our kids get to school, stay in school, and not be on the corners. That's a job for us to keep our kids intact. And by us being home sometimes, that helps keep the kids on a straight road.
Grandmother raising grandchildren. I would like to introduce Janina Gorman, who is a mother of five. She is of Indigenous descent, and some of her children are special needs, and she has been receiving the child tax credit. Janina Gorman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for inviting me here.
All righty, thank you. I'd also like to welcome Emma Marabi, who is the Director of Poverty Policy at the Children's Defense Fund, working to advance policy and advocacy efforts to end child poverty. She has worked on domestic poverty issues for over a decade, including 7 years spent working in Congress for Representative Barbara Lee, and most recently serving as her legislative director. Emma, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret.
All righty. So, Janina, we're actually going to start with you because you had been getting the child tax credit. The check that should have come at the end of this week won't be there. Tell us what that means for your family, the impact that the child tax credit has had, and now that it has stopped, what's going to happen?
I mean, when we were getting it, it was the ability to pay all my utilities, rent, and bills all at the same time without having to play which one needs to be paid first, which one can I afford not to pay so that I can pay for other basic needs to be met. The ability to take my children back and forth to specialists. My son in particular has to go back and forth to Pittsburgh. That's a two-hour drive from where I live to see various specialists on a regular basis. And we didn't have to worry about having the gas money to go down there and to make that trip. We're right now struggling because I lost my child care. I lost the person that was able to watch my kids and be a caregiver for my kids. And I was trying to get another job on top of my already full plate of working with three special needs children, all who have various appointments per day. And that's a full-time job. It's a full-time job making sure that my kids get to all their appointments, get to see all the specialists they need, get to go all the therapy appointments that they need so that they can have the best future. And parents and caregivers shouldn't have to choose between having a roof over our heads or, you know, making sure that our kids get the quality care that they deserve. And that is the choice that I am being forced to make this very month, in fact, without having that extra money coming in that we can count on. We're now being thrown into looking at, you know, our landlord is not patient. He wants his money, and I don't have all of it right now. It's possible that we're facing eviction. It's possible that a lot of things in our lives are going to be under upheaval very rapidly, very quickly. I do have specialists that want me to take my son back down to Pittsburgh. Right now, I can't afford the gas to go back and forth right now. I just can't. And those appointments can take 6 hours at a time for him to go in and get, you know, different procedures done, different tests and whatnot. And so we're looking at, you know, an 8 to 10 hour day just to go see a specialist in Pittsburgh for one child. And without having any backup, because I am a single mother, I'd have to take all three of my kids with me. You know, that's gas money, that's money for food, that's money for the ability to make my kids feel comfortable in that environment for, you know, 6 to 8 hours at a time that we don't have. So these are some of the really hard choices that we're being forced to make very rapidly. My daughter just broke her glasses again, and our insurance says that we have 5 more months before they'll cover another pair. I don't have $200 to pay out of pocket right now to buy her a new set of glasses. These are the things that we are facing right now that child tax credit helped us be a little bit safer in and be able to not have to choose between, right? I didn't have to choose between taking my son to get his medical appointments and specialists and getting my daughter glasses. Right now I do. I didn't have to choose between paying my rent or paying my gas bill. Right now we do. It's very, very rapidly hitting us very, very hard.
Right, and Janina, before we bring Emma into this conversation, I mean, one of the people who basically almost single-handedly, it seems, has stalled the child tax credit, Senator Joe Manchin from West Virginia, he is saying that everybody receiving the child tax credit should quote-unquote make an effort to work, should, you know, go out and get a job in order to be able to qualify for the child tax credit. What is your comeback to an argument like that, Janina?
What would I say to Senator Manchin? I would tell him that raising children is work. It's hard work. And there are millions of caregivers like me doing this work and struggling with very little or no support. Mothers and children are the fastest growing population of people who are homeless, and elected officials must act now. We have to stop this, and he needs to please extend the CTC so that families like mine can survive. It is now becoming a matter of survival, and especially with COVID, right now, my kids have had to quarantine 3 times in the past year. That's 30 days of missed work, 30 days of wage labor that I could not possibly do because of quarantining. How are we supposed to survive during COVID, during Omicron, during all of this without being able to have any type of steady income?
Right. And Emma, thank you for that. You know, Janina, just listening to you, it's such a heartbreak. I mean, you practically just break down and start to weep because your story is multiplied by millions across this country. And Emma, bringing you into this discussion right now, I mean, you heard Janina's story. Give us some numbers, the numbers of families who have been impacted, who have been helped by this child tax credit. And what do you say also to the argument that Senator Joe Manchin is using, West Virginia, one of the poorest states in the nation, saying, well, mothers are going to go out and use the child tax credit money to buy drugs? Emma.
Right. Thank you so much, Margaret. And let me just say it's always great to be with you, and I admire and respect you and all the work that you do. And I feel like I'm standing on your shoulders and the movement that you've created over the last several decades. So thank you. And just to Janina, I mean, as someone who is a soon-to-be mother and I'm currently pregnant, like, I also want the child tax credit. And I just want to echo what Margaret said, in that, you know, your story is so powerful, and also too common in our country. You know, we really put anyone who is struggling, you know, on the sidelines, and it's a damn shame if you ask me. So just in terms of the numbers, you know, again, I feel like this show should be focused on Janina, but as of December 15th, which was the last monthly payment out of 6 months for last year, 61 million children received that monthly payment, and over 36 million families, with an average payment per family of $444. And that's fantastic. And that number, both the amount of kids who were receiving it automatically and families, kept going up as we saw the first payment in July, right? And now it's expired. And so I think, Margaret, you touched on this a little bit ago, but, you know, just in terms of the impact, you know, not just on child poverty, right, but, and we've seen the numbers, there's 3.8 million kids who have been lifted out of poverty thanks to the child tax credit. You know, that's one analysis. Another analysis says that, you know, failure to extend the CTC means that 10 million kids could be pushed further or into poverty. And so, right, all the gains that we've made over the last, even just 6 months, could be completely eroded, and then particularly hit hard on Black, Latino, and Indigenous children, as we've seen for decades in this country. Regarding Senator Manchin's comments, I mean, you and I have talked about this, not on the show, but significantly, and again, echoing what Janina said, and that raising children is work. And so, Senator Manchin and any other politicians who want to add a work requirement to this child tax credit are not only taking away benefits from children and families, but they're penalizing caregivers who do the most critical work of our society, right? I'm someone who has taken care of not just my parents, but my nieces and nephews, and again, I'm soon to be a parent to be, so very excited to add that hat, that to add caregiving, you know, to my plate as well. But mothers and parents and caregivers and grandparents, they know how hard it is to raise children. But I think we also know that our children are a priority and they really are not negotiable. And so caring for children, you know, if we believe as a society that caring for children is one of the most important contributions we can make, then why are we having these policies that penalize caregiving, hurt mothers, particularly single mothers, and Black and Latino and Indigenous mothers? And it's just, it's really a slap in the face, and it's a line I keep using, but to give someone a benefit, take it away, mostly because of one senator, as you said, Margaret, is preposterous to me, and it's a failure of our institution, it's a failure of Congress, and it's a shame. It's shameful in so many respects. And I know, yeah. I know we believe at TDF that raising raising children is work, period.
Right.
We don't believe that there are any work requirements to be added to the child tax credit.
Right. And Janina, just I couldn't agree more. By the way, Emma, congratulations on being a mom to be.
Thank you.
You will be living what we say, which is every mother is a working mother. You know, our mm-hmm. children are our most precious resource, and we have to do what we can to ensure that they're not thrown under the bus, they're not thrown back into poverty. And also, there's really no such thing as a rich mom and an impoverished child, okay? So the you know, resources available to mothers and to primary caregivers, because they're grandmas and aunties, et cetera, who are also primary caregivers, will also no doubt benefit children. But Janina, from what I understand, some of your children are special needs kids, right? And I'm wondering how that impacts your ability to work outside the home, even if it is something that you felt that, you know, that you really wanted to do. And also, I'm wondering too about the mandate for you know, caregivers to go out and get a job outside the home, about also grandmothers. I know you're not a grandmother, but you heard Carolyn Hill, who is a grandma. She is raising three of her grandchildren. And is Senator Manchin then saying to grandmothers in the late 70s or early 80s, hey, you got to go get a job outside the home. If not, your grandchildren are going to be thrown into poverty, thrown into food security, et cetera. Janina Gorman.
I think that, you know, once again, I would say we are working. And, you know, a generation or two ago, it was possible for one income to come into the household and for that to be enough to survive. And it's not anymore. And so, like, our country has always thrived on the unpaid labor of caregivers, mostly women and mothers, but sometimes grandmothers or fathers as well. And that unpaid labor is valuable and it's necessary to keep this country moving. And until we give it the justice it deserves, the credit that it deserves, and understand that we're going to have a fundamental breakdown in society without these caregivers being able to care for our kids and have a reliable income, it's not going to get any better. This is invaluable to society as a whole. Like, when mothers are home with their children, when primary caregivers are able to be home with their children, children do better in school. Children do better in social environments. Children are able to succeed, are able to grow in ways that they can't if they don't have steady family taking care of them. And that is something that has been shown over and over and over again. And so this is work. This is unpaid work. I have three special needs children, actually, not two. And with three special needs children, what we're looking at is between 3 and 5 appointments a day that we need to make for my kids to be okay. And that choice of I have to go to work would mean that I couldn't do that. there's no way that I could make them to 3 and 5 appointments a day and still have a 9-to-5 job. There's not. Now, I have tried to do, I guess they call it gig work. In this area, the gig work is tipped labor. In Pennsylvania, tipped labor starts out at $2.85 an hour. It's not a lot of money, as you can imagine. But I can do gig work, delivery driving locally in the area, and take my kids with me if necessary. It's just not enough. It's not enough for us to be okay. And that's the only job that I can get right now without having to pay for childcare, which is also hard to find because my kids are over 12. And according to normal mandates, they're old enough not to have childcare, but because they're special needs, there's no allowances available for that. So how are families like me who are falling through the cracks supposed to adhere to these work requirements when we're already doing so much work to keep our families all right?
Right. Wow. Well, Emma, back to you. And of course, Emma is with the Children's Defense Fund, the Director of Poverty Policy at Children's Defense Fund, focusing then on what is happening in Washington, D.C., and to also explain to our listeners who may not be familiar or who may think they're not eligible to get any further funds, because the monthly payments for the child tax credit, just explain to us how that worked. There were monthly payments for a certain amount of time that ended in December, but also at tax filing time, there is additional funds that families can right. claim. Emma?
Right. Yeah, of course. And I also just want to, before we get into that, just say I think what Janina raised is just a really important point, is that we have these really sparse policies to support families. And things that she brings up is we don't have family-friendly federal policies or state policies that look at the comprehensive child, whether that's child care, universal pre-K, an actual child allowance that supports families to make the best decisions for themselves, and more. So I just want to make sure that we center that as well. So. Yes, the Child Tax Credit is a policy that's been around since 1997 and has been increased very smallly, actually, over the last several years. And for so many of us, including for Margaret and others who have been in this movement for so long, particularly in the welfare rights movement, you know, we have been pushing for this type of monthly benefit, monthly cash support for families. And so in the American Rescue Plan Act that was passed in March, that child tax credit was expanded significantly and for the first time ever given to families with low income or no income at all and on a monthly basis starting on July 15th. So the benefit went up from $2,000 per child to $3,600 for kids under 6 and $3,000 for kids 6 to 17, which means if you had one child, you could be getting anywhere from $250 to $300 per month. Obviously, multiply that by a few children, that's a sizable, you know, payment, whether you get it in your bank account automatically or in a check. And so those payments went for 6 months, July 15th to December 15th. We would have obviously preferred to see them in perpetuity, permanent, making that benefit even bigger, giving it to more families. But the way the law works is that families get 6 months of payments monthly, and then you're going to claim the second half of those payments when you file your taxes, on your 2021 taxes during this tax year. Now, the tax year does start on January 24th. The IRS actually just announced it this week. And for families who did receive the monthly benefit, the IRS is starting to send out letters. They're called, very oddly, the 6419 letter. And they will tell you how much you received on your benefit, and the IRS is going to ask you to keep that letter, which has important information on it, for when you file your taxes, however you file your taxes.
Let me ask you this, though, yeah. Before you go on. What about non-filers? What about families whose incomes are so low that they generally don't file taxes, but who had been receiving right. the monthly payments, because that was
part of what was won, wasn't it? That people whose incomes were too low on welfare, et cetera, that they could get the monthly payments without it impacting their other benefits. But what about the rest of the 6 months? What will happen to them? Do you know?
So it's the same. Yeah, it's the same program. So those families who, as you just mentioned, like don't normally file taxes or haven't had to because they don't meet the income thresholds or for whatever reason, right? Filing taxes is incredibly difficult in this country, makes it so hard for all of us to file taxes. It's ludicrous, but they will still be able to get that second half, right? So that's a significant amount of money. And that's right. The second, I'm sorry, I don't remember the full amount, but they'll still be able to get it. Now, I think what you raised earlier, Margaret, is these families were able to use a simple process to get it last year, right? Maybe they didn't have to file a full tax return. So they went on the IRS website and claimed the benefit, or they went to the Code for America website and got the CTC automatically, and they used a simple process and a simple tax return. Unfortunately, that process is not up and running this year, much to our disagreement with that. We will still be pushing to get up a simplified file process because we don't believe families should have to fill out a full tax return. Okay. And we think it's very confusing for everybody. But for now, people, our call to action is ensure that you fill out a full tax return in order to claim that second half of the benefit.
Right. So fill out a tax return in order to get your money. We are running out of time, I'm afraid, but very quickly, I would like to get some final thoughts from both of you. Also, I must say we have to lift up Congresswoman DeLauro. She's out of who has for the last two decades been working on this. She's in the House and on the Senate side, lifting up Senator Bennett and also Senator Sherrod Brown and others. So you may be able to tell us about some of those chants. But also, Emma, before we get some final thoughts from Janina, tell us, for people who are listening to this and who are absolutely outraged, as I am, that this money is stopping, and you have a Senator Manchin, but also Senator Sinema in Arizona is playing a role in all of this as well. What are people being asked to do now? Because there is a National Day of Action coming up this Friday, January the 14th. But in addition to participating in actions in your areas, social media, Twitter storms, et cetera, what are people being asked to do, Emma?
Yeah, so people, I think, really what Janina had already said, which is, you know, get to your pitch local stories as much as you can, talk about what the benefit means to you and what not having the benefit means to you. There will be a social media campaign with a toolkit that is going to be shared. And there's also a parent call-in day on the 14th. Where, you know, everyone's encouraging parents to call in to their district offices, you know, where their local House member is or their senator is, and talk about what the child tax credit means to you and why you think it not being extended and its expiration is bad and bad for your family. So we're hopeful that as many parents and caregivers and grandparents that can call in and talk about what it means online or, you know, to your local press reporters would be really fantastic.
Right. And what we'll try to do is we'll try to post that information on the Sojourner Truth social media so our listeners could get access to that. And also want to make a call out for any of our listeners who have been getting the tax credit or you know people getting the tax credit. Please contact us. You could email me directly at mpkpfk@gmail.com. We would like to collect those stories. We would like to share them, you know, with the general public so people know what's going on as well as elected officials. Now, we do have to wrap up. Janina, final thoughts from you.
I would just like to remind those in power that these aren't numbers, that these are people's lives. And these are people like my kids who absolutely need
and deserve to have lives where they're not struggling with poverty, with utilities, with food on the table. And that those numbers on a paper represent real people and real lives, and that we need this right now. We need this extra support right now, and we need to be able to take care of our families without having to worry about our basic needs being met and sacrificing one need for another.
Well, Janina Gorman, all the best to you and your children as you struggle through this difficult period. And Emma Mirabi, thank you so very much for joining us and for your work. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
All righty. We are going to take a station break now, during which time we hope to fix our technical difficulties. Stay with us. Joining us, Dr. Himmelstein will be joining us, the latest on the COVID pandemic. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Section on the child tax credit, our earlier show, please, from 10 this morning, for 90 days after that, you'll be able to get the show in its entirety, and you can subscribe for a free podcast. And we are also on our nationwide and worldwide on SoundCloud. And today I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Washington, D.C. International. I'd like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Ireland. By the way, that was Marvin Gaye's Inner City Blues, the music that you just heard. And if you are a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us there. Our handle on Instagram and Twitter, at So True Radio. We are now going to turn our attention to what is happening with the COVID-19 pandemic. Just when people thought, well, things would be getting back to normal, here came another variant. First, it was the Delta variant, then the Omicron variant that apparently is highly, highly contagious. So what I'd like to do is to get directly to our guests. I'd like to welcome Dr. David Himmelstein. He is a distinguished professor of public health at the City University of New York, a lecturer in medicine at Harvard Medical School, and a primary care doctor in the Bronx. Dr. Himmelstein co-founded Physicians for a National Program, a group whose 23,000 members advocate for Medicare for all. Dr. David Himmelstein, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
A lot of worry going on here now. Dr. Himmelstein, first of all, it was reported that Dr. Fauci made the comment yesterday that likely, at least if you are to believe the headlines, that most people or a majority of people will likely be infected with Omicron, the new variant. Tell us
is, you know, what does that mean? Because we're also seeing hospitalization at the highest level that it has ever been, while we're being told that Omicron, that the symptoms are relatively mild.
Well, really, Omicron looks to be two different diseases depending on whether you're vaccinated or not. If you're vaccinated, Omicron is somewhere between a cold and the flu in most cases. If you're not vaccinated, Omicron is often very, very serious. I mean, the flu can be serious, but usually is not nearly so. But if you're not vaccinated, for many people, Omicron means an ICU stay and even death. So it's emphasized the importance of being vaccinated, not necessarily to avoid getting the illness completely, but to make it a minor or very manageable illness rather than a potentially fatal one.
Yeah, and does that, by vaccinated, do you mean both shots plus a booster, or only both shots without the booster?
It does look like the booster is really an essential part of getting vaccinated at this point. And unfortunately, it looks like in the weeks and months ahead, we may well need to get additional boosters. So when we say vaccinated, we mean having the initial vaccines, but also the booster as well.
What about the concerns? I mean, there are those of us who have gotten vaccinated, who have gotten our boosters, but we know that there are many people who have not. There is a whole movement of people not being vaccinated, some for religious reasons, some for other medical issues. There's also a lot of misinformation floating around, around this. But what should people do to protect themselves? Because let's say you've been vaccinated, but you are at a job or in a supermarket or whatever in California, even though indoors masks are required, there are a lot of people who are walking around without. What's the best thing that people can do to protect themselves? Dr.
Well, it's pretty much the same things that we've been saying from early on in this pandemic, that keeping a distance and masks, and at this point we have plenty of masks and even plenty of the KN95 masks, that those do seem to be quite effective. So I know for people working in supermarkets and doing essential work in many settings, keeping a distance is not really feasible much of the time, but they can help protect themselves by masking, as well as protecting others against the spread if they were to have the infection. And for most people who have Omicron and have been fully vaccinated and boosted, it's actually either minor symptoms or no symptoms. So wearing a mask if you're not feeling ill may help prevent you from transmitting the virus, even though you don't know you have it. You might actually have the virus in your system for a few days.
Right, Dr. Himmelstein, so sorry to be asking you these questions, but it seems as though we have to be repeating this information again and again and again. Now, what about children? Because some children at a certain age group are now eligible for a vaccine, but there are also much younger children who are not. So tell us, what are the guidelines right now as you understand them for vaccination of children?
Well, for those of an age, I think it's over five, who are eligible for vaccine, we really have quite strong evidence that the vaccine is safe for them and effective for them. And unfortunately, it does look like Omicron not frequently, but sometimes causes serious illness in children. So that we're quite certain that vaccinating children who are of the age that the vaccine has been shown to be safe and effective protects them and is the thing that we ought to be doing. For younger children, they ought to be protected as much as we can with the public health measures, and you needn't apologize for repeating them. It's what public health does, is we say over and over again what the society and what individuals within the society need to do, because it's our behaviors that in many respects are the most important protections about illness. And frankly, at the individual level, that's about what we can do. The society needs to be much better about assuring people the conditions that their behaviors can thrive under. But in many cases, we don't control that individually. So for kids, get the vaccine if your child is old enough for it. If it's not, if they're not old enough for it, then masks around the kids. And even if what Dr. Fauci says is true, and it may well be that eventually almost everyone is going to get this, delaying getting Omicron is probably an important thing. We have much better treatments coming down the road in the next few months. And if we can delay people getting the virus, we're likely to be able to give them those treatments. And at this point, we need to try and relieve the hospitals of the strain of the huge number of patients who are getting sick. So I know, for instance, that the hospitals in the LA area, they're over capacity at this point. UCLA is at 105% of capacity, and the nurses and doctors and other workers there are being stretched thin. So holding off on behaviors, on activities that might increase your risk is important, not just for you, but to spare our healthcare system and to prevent you from transmitting to others.
Thank you for that. And what about parents who are so worried now because they've got school-age children, and there's been so much controversy around the opening of schools, what mandates should be put in place? We saw the situation in Chicago, which now we are hearing is now resolved, where teachers actually went on strike and were refusing to come in until measures were put in place. And it tends to vary from district to district. So any advice there, any thoughts for any members of school boards or for parents also who are really worrying about what should happen?
Well, I think the compromise they came down to in Chicago, that, as I understand it, sounds like a reasonable one, that in general we ought to be trying to restart our schools after vacations, and I guess LA has restarted this week. But when there's a huge outbreak in a school there, we need to take a pause and stop the spread of the virus. So my understanding is that the Chicago schools are reopening, but with an agreement that when a school has a large outbreak, that at a certain point you need to take a pause and try and interrupt that outbreak. And that's, I think, a very reasonable public health policy for schools more generally, is we need to get our kids in schools. By and large, they ought to be wearing masks, is my view, and the teachers ought to be wearing masks, and we ought to be practicing distancing insofar as it's feasible in schools. But we ought to be having most kids in schools, and where there's a large outbreak, then take a pause.
Right. And what about those who make the argument, who said, well, earlier in the outbreak, you know, schools were shut down, and there are a lot of parents, et cetera, who were upset about that. And now that schools are open with some measures in place, people are saying, well, you see that they shouldn't have been shut down in the first place. So any thoughts on that? Was it a mistake initially to do that? And, from what I hear you saying, there is a possibility, as in Chicago, that some schools may have to close given the level of infection. Any thoughts, Dr. Himmelstein?
Well, I think in the earlier phases of this pandemic, really before we had vaccines, it was a very different situation. So remember that until mid to late spring, we really didn't have the way to vaccinate people. And it wasn't just the kids who were potentially exposed from a spread of virus in schools. It was all of the people at home, and of course teachers, many of whom were highly susceptible to serious illness. So I think the vaccine really changed that. It said that we could much more safely reopen the schools and protect not just kids and teachers, but families at home, many of whom would have been gravely ill if they'd contracted the virus from their kids. So I think the situation has changed. And when I say we may need to shut down schools for, I'm really talking about a limited period. And I know it's very disruptive of families if you have a week or 2 week pause. But I think that in some circumstances where the virus is spreading, that may well be necessary.
Right. And also, before you dash, we have a few minutes left. Want to talk a bit about testing right now, because the President Biden has promised to get 10 million tests, I think, out to schools. There are some drugstores, et cetera, now some pharmacies where you can purchase the at-home tests. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about the difference with those two tests, but also the cost of these tests, because it's all well and good to say, well, we should test if we're going to visit grandma who's vulnerable or somebody who has a underlying illness, even if we are vaccinated, to make sure that we're not carrying the virus. But there is a cost issue for low-income people. Dr. Himmelstein.
Absolutely. And the production of tests is one of the many scandals about this this pandemic. So last I checked, the tests were running $20-$30 for a set of two tests, and that's out of reach for many families, and particularly if we're saying you ought to be doing it frequently to assure, you know, each time that you go to visit your grandmother or in other circumstances, we should have testing. So the price of the tests is outrageous. We ought to have had government production of those tests, not just relying on commercial firms that are charging outrageous amounts for them. And unfortunately, the at-home tests, if they're positive, they give you good information. But when there's a very high spread of the virus like there is today, even a negative test is only moderately reassuring. So we miss a fair amount of the diagnoses with the at-home tests, the what's called PCR tests that you really have to go into a health facility or testing center to get. We'll pick up more of the illness or the virus than the at-home tests. So I think the at-home tests are useful. They're not completely certain, but you know, this is, as I said, part and parcel of government failure, unfortunately, not just under the Trump administration, but under the Biden administration, to say we can't rely on for-profit corporations to bail us out of dire situations like this. We need government to act. And it's, as I said, the government ought to have been making these tests, and government ought to step in on the vaccine and now treatments for COVID and say those need to be provided at a reasonable price. I mean, we have the vaccine companies making $35 billion in profits from the vaccines this year. And that's just unconscionable. It costs them about $1 or $2 a dose to make these vaccines. And then they sell it for about $20, including to our government, which says, well, we'll buy it from you and make it available to the American people for, quote, free. But the government's paying huge amounts more than it actually costs the companies to make it. And that's profit. And it's profit that comes from our government funding the research, providing the startup funds for the companies to make the vaccine, and then saying, okay, we gave you $18 billion right at the outset for these to produce these vaccines, and now we'll let you make another $35 billion in profit from them. And of course, that also means that much of the world can't afford these vaccines and can't get them. You know, Moderna and Pfizer
right.
are refusing to share the recipes.
Well, on that note, I'm afraid, Dr. Himmelstein, we're going to have to leave it there because we literally have run out of time. But hopefully you could join us again. We really appreciate throughout this pandemic you coming on and being an expert here on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. Stay well and safe. All right.
Thank you.
We are out of time. Today's show produced by me. I'd like to thank Jose Benavides, who has helped with today's show, the engineer today, Wendell Handy.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. Your personality is the way you affect other people. Think about that. The way you affect other people.
Portland.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting